Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 69 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, February 25th, 2022. In the Art House, you will meet two classical musicians with a passion to educate the public about climate change. Sophie and Josie Davis are two members of Halcyon Quartet in the U.S. state of Maine. They share their successes, challenges, and questions about fusing art and climate change. But first, let's meet a rebel.
Two of our members knelt and prayed in front of Downing Street. So Downing Street is where our Prime Minister lives. It's a street that our Prime Minister and other members of, like, senior members of government live. So it's quite a well-known spot.
That's Caroline Harmon from Christian Climate Action UK.
So on one level, they were kneeling and praying, but they did it in such a way that they were blocking the entrance to Downing Street. At the time, our then Prime Minister was refusing to attend a meeting of global leaders to discuss the climate crisis. And we wanted him to reverse that decision and to go and to attend that meeting. Some of us had written letters and not had responses, or the response was, oh, he's just not going. So we knelt and blocked the entrance, which meant cars couldn't get in, visitors couldn't get in. It just created quite a lot of disruption. Sometimes it's about making it that people have to pay attention to you, that they can't ignore you anymore.
Way back in episode 9, Quaker activist Eileen Flanagan told us about four roles change agents can play: advocate, rebel, organizer, and helper. Now, I imagine most people listening to Citizens Climate Radio are advocates. You may volunteer your time trying to convince the public and members of Congress that we need to put a price on carbon. You approach congressional members and staff with respect and cordiality as you educate and persuade them to support climate solutions. The rebel, well, the rebel exists to put pressure on those lawmakers to get them to act.
Martin Luther King often talked about sort of creating a crisis or creating a tension that meant that someone who'd refused to engage with you up to that point had to engage with you. And in the end, our Prime Minister did attend that meeting. And there were lots of different things happening, lots of pressure on him from different organizations to attend. Hopefully we played a part in making that happen.
This doesn't mean we all need to use these rebel tactics. As Bayard Rustin, the Black gay civil rights leader, said, quote, "We need in every community a group of angelic troublemakers." In a moment, you'll hear about some tactics Caroline and Christian Climate Action use. Chatting with Carolyn, though, she seems like a very unlikely climate change activist rebel.
I grew up in a Pentecostal church, and for most of my adult life, I've been part of a charismatic church in the UK. As a child and a teenager, I didn't get that sense of caring for creation from my church, if you like. So thinking about John 3:16 and "For God so loved the world," I always heard "For God so loved the people." And it wasn't until I was a young adult that I started to realise that it really did mean that God cared for the whole world, not just the people, that he also cared for everything else, the animals, the plants, everything, and that God is redeeming the whole of creation, not just the people.
When she grew concerned about climate change, Caroline approached it in ways familiar to many of us.
Over the last two decades, I had made a lot of personal lifestyle change, you know, things like trying to be more energy efficient at home, and we don't own a car, we mostly use public transport. I put solar panels on my house. I still engage in that kind of thing. So for instance, at the minute, I'm doing what's called veganary. I don't know if that's just in the UK or elsewhere, but being vegan for a month to try that out as a diet, as a low carbon diet. So lots of different things to change my own lifestyle. I'd also encourage people in my town and in my church to make those sort of changes too. I had written to my MP, that's my member of parliament, to my local politician. I'd met with them in my hometown. I'd gone to London to meet with them in the Houses of Parliament. I'd taken part in sort of marches and lobbies where people were asking politicians to do more. I'd written a lot of letters to, you know, large companies that I felt were damaging the earth and could do better. I'd done all of that, and I think all of that has a role to play, hence I'm doing veganery at the minute. But I think just increasingly realised it wasn't having enough of an impact. When you looked at where we need to get to and how fast we need to get there to tackle the climate crisis, yeah, I thought this isn't all working. And then I had an opportunity to attend some sort of non-violent direct action that was taking place around something called fracking. And through doing that, met other Christians who were doing that, and we formed Christian Climate Action.
That was back in 2013. Little did Caroline know that the UK climate scene would soon be filled with even more rebels.
Since 2018, approximately, we've been involved in something called Extinction Rebellion, which is a big protest movement here. And I know it's kind of gone global a bit, but it originated in the UK. When we kind of get involved in those protests, we're sort of the Christian wing of Extinction Rebellion. That's how we've seen. We often hold prayer meetings or Eucharist or that kind of thing within the middle of those protests, because for us, prayer and protest go together.
Not only did the collaboration with Extinction Rebellion, or XR, bring in more people, it also gave Climate Christian Action a platform to be part of citywide actions. Back in episode 34, Robin Boardman shared with us the scale of the London actions.
The Rebellion Day, November 17th, 2018, when we blocked five of the major bridges in London with around 5,000 to 6,000 people.
Extinction Rebellion members insist we need to tell the truth about the climate crisis.
And act as if that truth is real and stop hiding from it.
When I first met one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion and he first came to explain what they were thinking to members of CCA, I thought, oh, if we really tell the truth, it's so depressing, it's so terrible, people will just kind of run, you know, they won't want to hear, they'd rather hear the positive message if we just tweak a few things. But actually it has worked, so it's had a huge impact. So as a result of the work that's happened, our government has declared a climate emergency, lots of our local governments have declared even more urgent climate emergencies, they've put a more urgent date on getting to net zero. And, you know, I've worked for quite a few small climate change focused charities, and it just became easier, I think, for them to have attention and to get funding to do what they do, because it just raised the profile.
One of the hallmarks of these nonviolent direct action campaigns is creativity. Their creative innovations help open up the public's imagination.
It's also sometimes about creating the kind of world you want to see, even if it's in a symbolic sort of way. So, for instance, we were involved in an action which blocked the entrance to a coal mine for a day, so it couldn't operate for the day. So it was basically saying, we don't want to be extracting fossil fuels, so we're just going to create a situation where you can't extract them, even just for a short period of time. And often Extinction Rebellion protests, within them we try to almost like create the version of the world that we would like to see. So even people might bring plants to have in the middle of the protest, or just kind of create the kind of world that we would like to live in. Sometimes direct action is just saying, this needs to be done. We're fed up of asking. We're just going to make it happen. If it can be theatrical and if it can be fun as well, you know, it doesn't have to all be negative. Obviously, it is something really serious, and it can feel very depressing that we're potentially talking about a breakdown of society as the climate emergency progresses. So sometimes we're kind of mourning, and we might be lamenting and mourning in a very theatrical sort of way. It can also be fun, and that can draw people's attention.
Outside a church denomination's synod meeting, Christian Climate Action set up a dramatic display to reveal the seriousness and urgency of the crisis.
We had cardboard coffins and flowers and held a whole service outside of that. And during their meeting, they made a decision to aim for net zero as a church by 2030, whereas previously, I think, they were aiming for 2050. So they brought that target forward. And obviously what we did outside synod was part of making that happen.
Being a rebel, or as Rustin called them, angelic troublemakers, is not for everyone. In fact, in Extinction Rebellion, they often remind followers how a small percentage of people can make a big impact.
Building on the research of people like Erica Chenoweth, who recognized that we need 3.5% of the population mobilized in order to create a system change, or that's a kind of maximum figure.
The reality is that everyone in the climate movement benefits from the work these rebels do. They put pressure on leaders, so leaders are more willing to sit down with advocates about the solutions we are proposing. Through their efforts, Christian Climate Action UK has brought together a coalition of diverse Christians, adding to the public demand on leaders to address the climate emergency.
And then within Christian Climate Action, our members come from a really wide range of churches. We've got Catholics, Anglicans, Baptists, Quakers. One thing I really like about being a member of Christian Climate Action is that we have that really broad base, and we all have in common that we care for God's creation. I think we probably have more in common than we have in difference, if you like. And despite maybe having a range of opinions on other subjects, that's what's brought us together in common. So that's what we focus on.
To learn more about Christian Climate Action, follow them on Facebook and Twitter. You can also visit their website, christianclimateaction.org. Now it is time for the Art House. Regular listeners know we feature artists who are using their art to explore climate change. This is an emerging field, and I especially love conversations with artists who are grappling with just how to integrate climate work into their works of art. Today, I feature two classical violinists who are not afraid to take risks. They choose to be good citizens as they remain faithful to their art. Meet Josie Davis.
When I was 4 years old, I started begging for violin lessons and grew up in a family where the idea of private mentorship wasn't something that was totally accepted or understood. And so my mom asked me to wait until I was 6 to start lessons. And at that point in my life, music became a daily ritual. Music started to become, I guess, more clarifying that it was going to be something that was quite central to my life and to my career.
And meet Josie's sister, Sophie Davis.
So I grew up in a really small rural town in Maine that's coastal, and spent a great deal of my childhood outside. And so I've developed a really strong appreciation for the natural world and just for paying attention and noticing what is going on out there. I took a climate change course when I was in high school. That class really started to inform me about the realities of climate change in the Gulf of Maine and just globally.
Josie explains the need to combine their two passions.
I have thought a lot about ways that music can feed into the dialogue around climate change, whether or not it promotes learning or reflection or understanding. The medium of music is powerful in that it's so evocative, and it can really draw a response of tenderness, of love, of joy, of sadness, of grief. Both my sister and I have been thinking a lot about ways that we can use music to create an environment and a response from people that is in response to the tragedy of climate change and also the potential for action and the responsibility that we all have to take action as we think about ways to mitigate the changing effects.
There is no competition or rivalry among these two professionally trained violinists, even as they worked hard together to hone their craft.
I would say it was more play than work for many, many years. We spent hours playing duets together and sharing the joy of learning together. And in addition to having the bond of being sisters and that really, really close connection, we're also best friends. I've played with many, many people, but playing with my sister is an effortless experience. When we don't play for a little bit of time, which may just even be a couple of weeks, when we're able to do it, there's this sense of exhale that happens as we play together because it just feels so easy and so comfortable. I very much treasure that.
Sophie shares how she and Josie founded Halcyon String Quartet 4 years ago.
We really just wanted to play string quartet music and found a cellist. Well, I wouldn't say we found him. He was a good friend of ours, and we started to play string quartets together. After doing a number of performances each summertime, we decided we wanted to create something more formal. We decided we needed a name, and then ended up really wanting to create a quartet that did more than just perform music, but had an environmental mission as well. We formed Halcyon, and it's sort of grown from there, just with a series of concerts, mostly in the local area in Maine, but also some out of the state as well.
These two sisters, absolutely love the coast of Maine where they grew up. Sophie reveals that even the name of their group was inspired in the water.
I spend a lot of time just brainstorming names, and I also work on an oyster farm on the Damariscotta River and have a lot of time where I'm doing somewhat monotonous tasks out there on the water, and I was trying to think up a name. I was looking at all the lobster boats go by and saw one called the Halcyon Days. So that's a cool word, and it's an interesting idea. And there's so much associated with Halcyon Days and the mythology behind it, and this idea of kind of the calm before the storm and these moments of tranquility. I brought that name to the group and we decided we'd stick with it. So it actually came from a lobster boat.
Yeah, you can't get more Maine than that. As I heard these two sisters talk about their successes and challenges in fusing their musical art with their concern for addressing climate change, it helped me identify six principles for creating climate art. 1, know your stuff. 2, think locally. 3, pursue collaborations. 4, pivot to solutions. 5, promote action. And 6, remain faithful to the art. So 1, know your stuff. Sophie and Josie are both well-trained and skilled musicians. By the time they were high school seniors, their lives were immersed in practice and performance. They then both attended the same music conservatory.
All of my coursework was focused in music in the conservatory, and I was spending between 4 and 8 hours a day playing. That concentrated period of 4.5 years of music study, I think, is really the time when you refine your craft, because you have so much time, the luxury of time, to spend hours a day really deeply scrutinizing your technique and learning repertoire and understanding the craft in a nuanced way.
The sisters also know their stuff when it comes to climate change.
Both of my parents are scientists. My father studies the oceans and my mom studies the mainland areas. We grew up having a lot of conversations as a family about what was happening in the world around us ecologically, really being observant to that. Some things that really have shaped my feelings about climate change are anecdotal in a lot of ways. Memories related to my experience as a child and how they've changed. For instance, I used to be able to walk from our house, which is on a saltwater river, into town about 4 miles because it would ice over. And I used to be able to play outside all day long and never see a tick. And now Lyme disease is really prevalent in Maine. It's a dissuasion from being outside where ticks are in a way that it never used to be. We would scour the weather in the summer to find the hottest day that we could go to the beach because it would only ever reach 80 degrees, maybe once or twice over the course of the summer months. And now we see these prolonged periods of heat waves. And so these kinds of changes have been really eye-opening to me, and I think have been the impetus for really thinking about our responsibility as humans to respond to the urgency of climate change. I live in a community where a lot of people rely on the oceans for their livelihoods, whether it's fishing, lobstering, or the shellfish industry as a whole. Noticing that the sea level is rising or that the water temperatures are warming is alarming. It starts to affect the communities that are intimately surrounding us in ways that call for action.
This brings us to the second principle: think locally.
Staying, at least in this community, staying local is incredibly important. I think that's what people relate best to. It's also something really tangible. One thing that I'm particularly excited about here in Maine is just the influx of solar power and solar initiatives. And I think that's something, I don't know entirely how would do a program focused around this, but it's something I've been exploring and just thinking about working with energy retrofit groups or things that have no artistic affiliation normally, but I think would potentially be willing to partner for a project coming at it from a different perspective, not from the arts perspective, but linking that in.
Change and action can be pretty impactful when it starts locally, and the idea of trying to influence whether or not it's politics or policy at a larger scale can feel unmanageable or unrealistic in a lot of ways. But I think that the possibility for change from our local community, and then that inspires change at the county level and then the state level and then works its way up, that feels really hopeful to both of us.
Creating and performing art connected to a space leads to deeper relationships with the audience and within the community.
We both feel most inspired when we're pulled back home. The audiences we've grown to know, we have relationships with a lot of the people that come to our concerts. It feels more reciprocal, I think, because we're building on something that's growing and deepening rather than maybe an experience that's a one-off or something that happens and then passes and you may never encounter those audiences again.
Principle number 3, pursue collaborations.
There's a richness in getting a lot of people together to create something.
One of our first collaborations that we did with an incredible artist who's based in Portland, Maine, Jill Pelto, who creates watercolor paintings using climate change data, but very specific to a place. They're pretty stunning paintings. I saw some of her work at a gallery showing and reached out and asked if we could collaborate. We did a performance that paired her artwork as well as some photographs that were depicting climate impacts in the Arctic and photographs of the local area here in Maine. We paired this imagery with music and then wrote a script that was kind of more of a storyline rather than an essay or something. We presented that with music we tried to match to the content. The sounds evoked certain emotions, tried to capture what the imagery was showing. And then we presented this for in a public performance and then also for two school assemblies, and then got feedback from the students through a survey and a question and answer period. It's really hard to contextualize the data. And so working with an artist who can do that for us in a way has been really helpful. We did a few other performances that were less pointed, less specific. That was harder. I'm not sure that we really communicated the message that we wanted to. It was more of an evening of music with some visuals that didn't quite connect.
As we have seen with other artists who we featured in the Art House, Halcyon String Quartet is looking for ways to highlight solutions. That is principle number 4, pivot to solutions. In other words, shift the focus away from climate impacts and instead envision and reveal the impacts of climate solutions.
I was really inspired by a NPR piece at least a year ago now, looking at what the world will look like in 2100 if we tackle the major issues. It's a completely positive account of where we'll be in terms of what infrastructure looks like, what social structures look like, what our environmental regulations are, and how healthy we are. I would love to do something that involves students, maybe having them depict that, draw it, and then share their artwork as part of a performance, showing what the world will look like with the solutions in place rather than constantly nagging everyone to do their part. That can get tiresome and is only effective for certain people.
In addition to informing and inspiring audiences, artists need to consider how to engage their audiences. This leads us to the 5th principle, promote action.
When we're able to engage the audience in a way that's more than just as a passive listener, the outcome can be more impactful.
That said, Josie explains, finding ways to engage the audience so that it leads to action is still a work in progress.
As we're thinking about this next stage of work to address climate change that's more action-oriented, we have started to talk more about ways that we can use our concerts or our projects to show change, to show action, and to inspire action. I don't have an answer. It's something that I'm still evolving. Partnering with other organizations or other artists or other scientists or policymakers or community members, elected community members, for instance, is a really great way to push the work forward.
Finally, Sophie and Josie constantly strive to embrace principle number 6, remain faithful to the art. Josie explains how we have to push ourselves and our audiences.
One of the things that I've been really thinking a lot about is the actual programming, the music itself. What is the music that we're sharing? And that, I think, is we're at this inflection point where the music that we've been playing has been highly dominated by Eurocentric white men, male composers. That's problematic. As we've been thinking about ways to reimagine our program, we've also been learning about how tunnel focused we were in our education around this region and this kind of composer. Both my sister and I have been spending a lot of time thinking about ways that we can share music by underrepresented composers and music that's not just based in European traditions. Because I think when we're trying to tell stories, whether or not it's musical experiences, experiences that are purely musical, or projects that encompass other topics like climate change, we have to think about representation and what we do. We have avoided it in the past. I feel that's been really problematic and is a mistake. So it's something that we are very committed to learning and unlearning as we think about future programming.
Sophie and Josie also recognize the temptation to play music that is familiar to the audience, those well-known classical hits that are easy listening.
I've thought a lot about this because there are a number of pieces I would love to play, but don't for that reason. Though the more I've thought about it, the more I think it's possible to play those if they're paired with imagery. I also find most music that's not too long, if it's played in a really compelling way, I'm more willing to take a chance at this point. There's an element of trying to play what audiences will like, and there's an element of showing them things they've never heard before. And I'm really passionate about doing both of those things.
I don't know that artists or musicians are going to solve climate change in any way or be, you know, at the forefront of the actual decisions that people need to make in order to reduce our impact. But I do think that musicians are really good partners and really good storytellers. There's an opportunity to be communicators in a way that I think is going to be really important.
It's a story that I think resonates most with people, and too often science and climate change are not presented in a way that's telling a story. They're very dry and disconnected from humanity, and I think climate change is probably the most connected to humanity that we can get in terms of issues that we face.
Find out more about Josie, Sophie, and the other two members of Halcyon String Quartet at the website halcyonstringquartet.org. There you will also see videos, photos, and learn about upcoming events. That's halcyonstringquartet.org. If you have an idea for the Art House, please feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. Thank you so much for joining me here for episode 69 of Citizens Climate Radio. Now, here at Citizens Climate Education, we have a solution that will greatly reduce pollution. We believe putting a price on carbon will make a massive difference. We want to tell you more about it, so please visit cclusa.org/price on carbon. That's cclusa.org/price on carbon. Citizens Climate Radio is produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Kitty Sokreski, Alyssa Tennant, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. I want to thank everyone who has rated and reviewed our show over at Apple Podcast. Oh my gosh, it's so lovely reading those reviews. It gives me so much encouragement, and it actually helps other people see our show. So thank you for that. You can find our show wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. We have a discussion ongoing at our Facebook group page. Check us out, Citizens Climate Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter at Citizens C Radio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org to see our show notes and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.